I don't live like that large lifestyle. I've always lived below my means. Like,
Yeah.
so that's why, and I think that's part of how to build wealth is to figure out how to live below your means. And then eventually, it's just, if you've got, if you're a student of business, money, personal development, relationships, the success wheel, all that stuff. If you're just a student, you're just going to get better and better and better over time.
Welcome to the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success Magazine. I'm Kirsten.
And I'm Julian.
And today we are so excited. We have a guest. It's not just the two of us going back and forth. We are interviewing Glenn Sanford, who is the CEO of Success Enterprises, as well as eXp Realty. How you doing, Glenn?
Good, Kirsten. How's it going? Hey, Julian.
Hey, hey.
It's great. We are getting ready for a road trip and figured we could have a conversation with you that we'll just continue to talk about you in the car and everything that we've learned and just kind of recap to keep the ride interesting.
Yes, I'm very much looking forward to this conversation.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. Well, I am as well. So thanks for doing this with me, and thanks for everything you're doing. Obviously, it's been a few months now. What? 5 months, 4 months, been part of the Success ecosystem and all of that.
Yeah. It's been great. The team has been wonderful. Josh.
It's one of those things where it feels like we just started, but it also feels like I've known y'all forever.
Yeah.
it's like a marriage, like a really intense marriage.
Oh, hopefully not too intense.
No, in a good way.
Don't comment on that.
I was going to say like a shotgun wedding, but then I was like, no, that's perceived negative. But sometimes those are really good. Like you just love each other so much, you just get, immediately right. Married.
Well, awesome. I heard somebody the other day say, somebody goes, and she was 15, and it was, actually, I think our upcoming cover, Glenn and Mindy Stearns, their oldest daughter goes, I could probably do with an arranged marriage. I trust you to find me a good partner when I get older. It's much easier than trying to do the whole dating and figure stuff out.
I agree. Bring them back.
I also think parents are kidding themselves. They've been trying to do that their entire life.
Right.
We were with her mom, and they were with their aunt or someone else, and they were already like trying to get their kids out of the house and also like have them fall in love.
Oh, that's right.
They were already like planning arranged
marriage.
Parents
love hooking their kids up.
Yeah. Well, anyway, this interview is obviously not about marriage and arranged marriages. This is about money and about you. We've got a really short list of questions. I think they're rather interesting, but they're all easy, none of which requires you to prepare for them. But I want to jump right in because I don't want to do any of the boring tell me about you sort of things. I think there's a plenty.
Not that you're boring, Glenn.
Well, you know what I mean. You've answered those questions hundreds of times before. It's in the magazine. It's on the website. That information can be found if people want to know a little bit more about you in terms of your work history, that sort of thing. But I'm trying to tie together sort of who you are, what we know about you, and what we want people to get out of this particular podcast. And one of the questions, one of the first questions I would love to ask is really around standard rules of thumb in personal finance. Because we found as someone who is in that sort of world that there's a huge appetite. People want to be told what to do, how much, what specifically to do. And I'm curious if there's any personal finance advice that you just flat out disagree with. You just disregard it because it's not something that you find to be very valuable.
Certainly, there's some people who don't believe in any sort of debt.
Yeah.
At all. And I think there's good debt and there's bad debt. I think one thing is just understanding, what actually makes sense, what's truly risky and what's not. A lot of people, when they're just getting started, and this would apply to me as well when I was younger, is if you don't take on some debt, then it could be just credit card debt. You're not going to create enough momentum to get to sort of break through, that first level of financial security. So taking on a little bit of risk and a little bit of an opportunity from a risk standpoint actually makes a lot of sense. So I'd say first thing is don't ignore debt as a potential tool. There's probably a few others that I'll probably jump into as well. I mean, some of the stuff I definitely agree with is, and I know you guys as well, but living below your means is such a huge tool to actually building financial freedom.
Yeah.
And whatever level you live at is whatever level you live at. And so if you can live 20% below your means, 30% below your means, 50% below your means, whatever that number is, that then starts to create the opportunities for good things to happen in the future. It's a delayed gratification that takes place in sort of what we call it. I like to sort of think about how do you create delayed gratification on steroids? What are the various things that you need to put in place to create opportunities in the future, which are very, very significant over time?
I love that. I love delayed gratification on steroids. That sounds like something I need to try. So I mentioned at the beginning that you're not just the CEO of Success Enterprises, you also lead eXp Realty and have a long line of businesses that you kind of started in the tech space. For the common investor, what role do you think that tech should play in their portfolio, the tech sector to be specific?
Yeah, in terms of investments or in terms of their own personal businesses?
In terms of investments. So if you were making a cup of coffee and your total investments was the coffee and tech was the cream, right, is there like a percent or a ratio, knowing what you know about technology and how quickly it's shaping our lives, that you would recommend for people?
Yeah, I mean, can I say more than 100%? Am I allowed to?
You are allowed to say that.
You can say the coffee. You can say tech is the
coffee and everything else is the cream.
Yeah, everything else is the cream. No, but if you look at it, and I'm a big, are you familiar with Can Slim, Investor's Business Daily style of investing?
No.
Okay, yeah. So William J. O'Neill wrote a book back in the, I think it was the 80s, called How to Make Money in Stocks. And I was a stockbroker back in 1987, 88. And so at that point, I ended up working as a stockbroker for a company that was actually pitching stocks that weren't very good. So after about 6 months to a year, I went back to the drawing board. Okay, this really didn't work well. So I ended up just studying investments and trying to figure out which stock investments made the most sense. And so William J. O'Neill is a big one, and he has this thing called Can Slim. So it stands for current earnings, growing 30% year over year, sales growth. But then do they have a new technology? So new technology was like one of the criteria. So like seven criteria that you look for. And one of them is there something new in the marketplace that's going to kind of disrupt some portion of the marketplace? And usually that's tech. Mm-hmm. And so if you can figure out what that is on the early stages of its growth, and you can sort of get in while institutions are starting to build their positions early in the life cycle of a company, you can get some significantly outsized wins in your investing portfolio. So for me, it's always been very, very tech enabled. I developed some strategies from a guy named Courtney Smith, where I'm buying stocks when they break out of the 55-day high and mm-hmm. then sell when they hit the 22-day low. But these are all companies that are 30% year-over-year growth rates, both on sales and earnings. And then when it breaks that 55-day high, it's usually the beginning of a trend. And then how do you size up your investments? And so I'll do that system when I've got time. It's not super difficult, but I'll use that system to sort of just build my tech portfolio. And right now I'm actually fully invested because the market's actually been pretty good here recently. So I basically bought in, and so I'm starting to actually tap into some of my margins. So assuming the market keeps on doing what it's been doing lately, I'll be actually using some margin to create some better returns if all the stocks keep on doing what they're supposed to do. But they're all tech. If you're interested, I'll even tell you some of the stuff I got in my portfolio.
Yeah.
What do I got? Actually, I've got a kind of a variety of stuff, but I've got Shopify, of course. You've got to have Shopify in your portfolio. I've got Expel, EXPL. I know they're involved with Tesla somehow. Then I've got a couple pharma stocks in there. PayPal. I'm in PayPal again. What's another? Roku. Roku's been really good. Roku did last week. It took a was on a tear. So, but anyway, those are a few. And then Crocs, the little shoe company. It's not really a tech play, but you know. And Lululemon, I got some of that. That's not really tech.
I just put my foot in a pair of Crocs for the first time like 2 weeks ago.
With
and
socks.
I was like, I know, I wore it with socks. I went full like Croc. And like, I get why they're a religion now. Like, they are incredibly comfortable. It's like a cloud on your feet. Like,
there you go.
I want to get a pair. I just haven't done it yet.
Well, if you buy a pair, buy a share of stock too. How about that?
There we go.
I want to stay on tech a little bit because one of the things that really intrigued us as we first started speaking with you and the team at Success is as you were sort of introducing yourself, you were talking a little bit about VR. And I believe you're also the owner of a virtual reality company as well. We are virtual reality enthusiasts. And we are very excited about the possibilities and how virtual reality is going to be sort of the next big thing. And so very similar to what you were saying in terms of disruptive technologies. I think VR is still has quite a way to go. But I think once it really hits mainstream, it's going to be really disruptive. I would love to know a little bit about why you're so enthusiastic or bullish about VR and what role you think that plays in terms of changing the way that we work and live in the future.
Yeah, so for me, you know, we bought Virbela, which is a virtual world for work platform. It's Oculus ready. It's not the Quest. So you still need to be wired in. But we've got another company inside of Virbela called FrameVR.io, which is actually you can wear the Quest, you know, headsets, and so you can go with wireless headsets and be able to go in world. But what it does, in my opinion, is allows you to be work from anywhere, but have a shared experience around a sense of place. Mm-hmm. So if you think about what an office represents a shared experience in a physical space, and you know, which works great. You're in a big city, and you got, you know, San Francisco or whatever. You know, everybody can come to the office; they can have the shared experience, but. You know, the challenge with that is that you're now, you have to be within, you know, if you're in Silicon Valley, you can be within 2 hours of the office. But, you know, if for a normal person, they don't want to be more than about 30 minutes away from the office, right?
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
And then it becomes really more of a challenge to get to the office than it's worth. And so what, you know, VR specifically does is it allows you to create these really unique experiences that, especially when you think about community and collaboration, can solve for you can be anywhere on planet Earth and be working together. Especially now you got Elon Musk throwing up a bunch of Starlink satellites. I should be getting my dish here pretty soon, and then I'll be able to be out on the boat and be able to have high-speed internet, in which case nice. With a pair of Oculus headset. Now, I don't really like the headset per se, but I like the 2D version of 3D. So if you see Virbela, you see FrameVR, you see a bunch of stuff, Altspace, Mozilla Hubs, you know, there's a bunch of the stuff that you can actually do without a headset. I actually think that that's more approachable for 95% of users. And then you've got these, you know, superpower users that are going to want to, you know, stick on the headset and live in virtual reality and, you know, Ready Player One their life. But, you know, you know, most of us, we, you know, as long as we can see that, I think there's Julian that's sitting over there in the couch. Let me go walk over there and talk to him. That's probably, you know, good enough for most of us.
Yeah, I bought an Oculus headset, I'm going to say about a year ago, for Christmas.
A little longer.
Maybe it was a little over a year ago. And at the time, I really just bought it for gaming. But as I started exploring different applications within it, I started thinking about the future of even managing finances. And so beyond just, let's say, replicating or creating a different type of work environment, I was thinking about imagining a world where you can visualize your portfolio. So it's not just looking at it, in a one-dimensional or two-dimensional world, like truly sort of going or following yourself along that journey, or even just consulting, right? With, from advisor to client relationships, like all of these different things, I really started to get excited. And obviously as a creative, there were some storytelling elements in there as well, but I'm really excited about what's happening with VR. And as I said, when you mentioned that, I sort of felt a bit of a connection. I was like, here's someone who's really thinking about the next big thing. Because, it's not to say that where we are today isn't exciting, but there's certainly something to be said as you start to imagine what's coming next. Mm-hmm. Because things are great and really efficient now, but there is a lot of things coming down the pipeline.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm probably, more bullish on things like augmented reality. Like the Microsoft HoloLens kind of experience, mm-hmm. or something where you can see in your physical surroundings, or and maybe you can sort of turn them on, turn them off a little bit. Right now, you've got the Oculus headset, and you got that. You can have a grainy view of your of where you're at physically, but I like the idea like that HoloLens has, which is where you can literally like put objects in different parts of your room and your house. And as long as you got your headset, when you think about personal finance, you could have on your wall, you're the only one that can see it, but what's my portfolio doing? And mm-hmm. you're like, and somebody goes, why are you grinning? Yeah, 'cause over there.
Is augmented reality, there's like a Google commercial where a kid is like looking up octopuses or something, some sort of sea animal, and he like beams it on the coffee table and he can actually like study it up close. Is that the same technology?
Same general technology as that is it. And it still isn't mainstream yet. I think the computing power is still a little bit heavy, but in the not too distant future, you'll put on a pair of cool looking, sunglasses that aren't really sunglasses, and you're going to see all kinds of stuff that's added, and of course nowadays, at some level tech's kind of scary because, you can, facial recognition, you can't even walk through a city anymore without, cameras wanted to, they could know who you are, anything about you. I mean, what was that, Minority Report? Remember when Tom Cruise is walking through the mall and it's like, he had the wrong set of eyes, right?
Yeah. Okay. Switching gears a little bit, we are in the process of finishing up our book. And one of the things that we're constantly looking for is like the right metaphor, the right sort of wrapping to kind of explain difficult or complex or maybe just new financial concepts to people. And so the other week we were recording a podcast where we were trying to explain what a brokerage account was, and we referred to it as an emergency investment account. Is that what we said? An emergency investment account.
Yeah. Well, we were asking people to also think of it that way.
Yes. Right?
So it's not just a place where you have your portfolios, but imagine a world where there's a great opportunity that presents itself. Where do you draw or pull the money from? Ideally, you wouldn't want to pull that from, let's say, a tax deferred account because you're going to get hit with a penalty. And there's other sort of obstacles that are put in place for a reason so that you don't touch that money. But a taxable brokerage account in many ways can act like an emergency investment account. And mm-hmm. the reason why we were thinking about that yes. is because we
had heard your story.
And when the success opportunity or the opportunity to acquire or buy success came your way. So one, we were hoping you could give us a share that story with our audience a little bit. How did you come to buy the company? But more interestingly, where was the money stored?
Yeah. So the first thing was, I was Stuart Johnson, previous owner of Success Magazine. We were in EXP Realty mailing Success Magazine to all of our agents. Now, EXP Realty is a tech-enabled real estate brokerage where you have no physical bricks and mortar offices. All of our agents work 100% remote. Today, we went over 60,000 agents worldwide. And the company's been around less than 12 years from inception. But one of the things that we wanted to do was we wanted to get personal development content and something physical into agents' hands with a little bit of a EXP wrap. So we were doing that for a couple of years, and then the opportunity came up. Then it went away in early September, and then it came back again in October. And so I think on a Saturday, Stuart sent me a note, he said, I've got something to talk to you about. Called him back. He says, hey, the previous buyer felt their offer fell through. I think you might want to still buy it. I said, okay, well, here's the deal. I'm going to send you some non-refundable money. It was $500,000, but I sent him $500,000 on Monday and said, don't, you know, let's figure it out. Let's make it happen. But, I needed to be able to move quickly, and fortunately, I had the money sitting there in my account. Now, I wouldn't call it emergency funds per se. I, as the founder of a publicly traded company, I'd been on a small 10b5-1 plan that was creating a little bit of liquidity for me, and so that it just happened that it just matched up timing-wise. But the flip side of it is from an using your emergency plan or emergency thing, I think that's real. I think there are going to be situations in your life as an individual investor where if you don't have your brokerage account, your option account, your whatever tool that you want to be able to use when an opportunity shows up, and a lot of times the timing around those opportunities are very short, like. I remember, a number of years ago, I could see that there was going to be a sell-off in the market. And a lot of times if you see I became a stockbroker in 87 after the big crash in 87. So what a time to become a stockbroker. But what I saw was 87, then there were 90, then there was different points in time where the market would start to sell off on during maybe the prior 2 weeks, then like Wednesday, it's take a little bit of a pretty good down day. Thursday take pretty good down day, and then Friday you could tell that we're going into a little bit of a meltdown. And I wanted to get options, and I didn't have money to get my option position. And sure enough, on the following Monday, the market just cratered, and I wanted to buy a bunch of puts. And so I missed out on like two opportunities to make like a lot of money in a very short period of time. So those are a couple that's a reason why you want to make sure that at least you got your platform in place to be able to take advantage of market opportunities. And obviously, if you've got a little bit of liquidity, cash, you know, whatever tool you have available, then you can make those moves quick.
Yeah, no, I love that. You know, we obviously don't have those kinds of opportunities being presented to us, but as I was thinking about that, I was like, well, where would you store that money, right? I mean, that's not sitting in cash, right? And so especially for people who are entrepreneurs that are looking to venture into different industries, like you really do actually have to think about all of the different multiple purposes that these accounts can serve. And you can open up multiple brokerage accounts. You can have one that is just for long-term investing, mm-hmm. but you can have one that's sort of designed or that's just monitoring to serve those purposes or any number of purposes. But that's the whole point of it, is that it gives you a lot of flexibility to do with it as you please without any restrictions.
Yeah. And of course, you guys are educating people about money all the time. But the more you start to work with money, the more you understand money.
Yeah.
And the more you understand money and how it works and what makes things change value fairly quickly or opportunities that show up, the more you play with it, the better you're going to get with it.
Yeah. I love the word play, because I like to have a playful relationship with my finances, because that's what keeps it fun. I am curious though, do you have an emergency fund at all that the traditional finance advice is like, have, 3 to 6 months of living expenses stored somewhere. Do you have an emergency fund?
Well, not an emergency fund per se. I mean, I've been building up some cash more recently, but not for my purposes of emergencies. But I do like to, the beginning of last year, I went heavy into crypto, which good time to go heavy into crypto. And so I was able to pull some cash and, you know, I was trying to get money in my Coinbase account from JP Morgan, and JP Morgan didn't want to send any money over because it was like, mm-hmm. whatever. So I said, okay, well, wire it to my Bank of America account, then I'll wire it to my Coinbase account. And they found out since I was going to do that, they decided they'd just send it direct to Coinbase.
It's always funny when that happens.
That is an excellent segue. I feel like you're reading my mind. And speaking of, I've been reading your tweets, Glenn. Do you know what you tweeted on November 27th, 2013?
It was probably a little bit around crypto and Ben Bernanke and crypto going over $1,000.
Yeah. So you said, wondering if I'm late to the Bitcoin party with my first Bitcoin purchase.
Oh,
looks like you were in a Thanksgiving mood, I guess. My question for you is, do you remember how much you paid for the coin, roughly? And do you still believe you were late?
I paid around $1,000for the Bitcoin. I don't think I actually bought that much at that point in time because I had to go through. Do you remember Mt. Gox? Do you remember the story of that? That was the Mm-mm. Magic the Gathering. That was the first place where they used Bitcoin as these dollars that they would just trade between members. It really had nothing to do with making money because nobody really knew there was use. But it was the first place that got, you know, Bitcoin sort of an ecosystem, and then so you had to jump through hoops. You had to go into Second Life. Remember Second Life?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you go into Second Life, and you had to go to you had to buy Linden dollars from Second Life. Then you had to go to an ATM in Second Life to then buy Bitcoin through an ATM that would only work in Linden dollars to Bitcoin. So that's how I got my first Bitcoin.
I don't think people know like how steep the barriers to entry were back then. I think everybody likes to romanticize that like they would have bought Bitcoin in 2013, but we're assuming that something as simple as an interface as Coinbase was around then. And it's like, oh yeah, I would have put $25 in there or $100. But hearing that makes me think that even if I had known about Bitcoin in 2013, I probably wouldn't have gone through all those steps.
Yeah, you would have been discouraged.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't, you know, and the first Bitcoin ATM started to show up. And so there was one I live just south of the Canadian border in downtown Vancouver at Waves Coffee Shop. There was a Bitcoin ATM. So I had to go up to the Bitcoin ATM. And this is in probably March of 2014. So I was pretty excited. And then I had... I built two going on three mining rigs
mining
for altcoin. And then I bought a Bitcoin mining rig as well. So I was mining for Litecoin and a bunch of other stuff that's sort of in that sort of genre. And then a specific ASIC miner using Bitcoin mining. And I quickly figured out that you could never make money mining. Mm-hmm. You were way better off actually buying the crypto. So I'd put $7,000 into hardware, and then I would try to sell it. I sold my Bitcoin mining rig, but I wasn't able to really sell the rest of the equipment because, you know, there wasn't a huge demand in my neck of the woods. Craigslist wasn't a great place to try to sell mining rigs in 2014. So anyway, I gave all the cards to a buddy of mine, but I just went in with crypto and 2014, and they just came down and down and down. And then I got out. But when I got in really big again was beginning of 2017. I think I was buying Ethereum at $19 a coin, or it might have been as low as $9 a coin. And I was buying, I think in 2016, remember when Trump was getting elected on election night? And the market took the crater. Mm-hmm. And I'm like going, oh, the market's going to hell in a handbasket. What do I do? And I had $5,000 in my Coinbase account, and so I immediately bought $5,000 worth of Bitcoin at $700.
Nice.
And so I went in between there and the beginning of 2017, bought a fair bit, and then I ended up buying a boat because of that run up in crypto. So our first boat, we ended up getting because we got the down payment because of crypto.
Nice. I was going to ask if your strategy, even back in 2017, was to hold, or were you looking to trade and cash out on profits, you know, along the way?
Yeah, I've been using kind of this 55-day high, 22-day low strategy for a long time. It's been worked really well for me. And so, and there's some sizing around it, like how much risk you take on every trade. So I started doing that. And so I ended up getting fairly fully invested into cryptos over the course of a series of trades. And then I was just in for the ride of through 2017. And then 2018, and on cryptos, I instead modified it from my stock rules, which is 22-day or 55 and 22, to 30 days and 90 days. So 90-day high and 30-day low. And so if it breaks the 90-day high, then I can buy. And if it breaks the 30-day low, then I have to sell everything that I've got. So those are my rules. And so I was in the run all the way up to 2018. Unfortunately, I put a bunch of my crypto on paper wallets and put it in a safety deposit box. And I was on vacation when crypto started to take a dive.
Oh.
And so I had to wait a few days before I got back to after it broke my 30-day low. So I ended up, I still did great, but I would, I went from 700, let's say my average price of a Bitcoin was 1400, but I think I sold most of my Bitcoin on that run. Well, it was up to above 10,000.
Yeah. So. Wow.
I've got one last question for you. Obviously, we can continue talking. I do think we have a little bit of time here, but the more we talk about money, to your point, the more we learn about money, we are actually far more interested in the social and cultural layers of money, how people come to make decisions or avoid decisions entirely, and really the role that money plays in shaping people's identity. One of the things that we've shied away from recently are some of the sexy labels like millionaire and multimillionaire, because I think people see that, and because they may not be able to, let's say, identify with the visual that they've come to see, they feel like achieving that level of financial success is unrealistic. But it made me wonder, because you are a billionaire, how much do you identify with that label? And do you describe yourself as such?
No, I mean, I definitely don't describe myself as such. I don't live like that large lifestyle. I've always lived below my means. So that's why, and I think that's part of how to build wealth, is to figure out how to live below your means. And then eventually, it's just, if you're a student of business, money, personal development, relationships, the success wheel, all that stuff. If you're just a student, you're just going to get better and better and better over time. As long as you're not, trying to spend everything today. So always, yes. Always using some of what you're doing. But it's a really interesting term. Almost all of my net worth is tied up in my ownership inside the company. And the fact that we're publicly traded gives a sort of quoted price. So you take quoted price times number of shares, and all of a sudden it creates this value. But if I was to sell all my stock tomorrow and say, leave, I don't think I'd be that. I think I'd have a hard time getting 100% liquid, and I'd probably get some decent money out of it. But my goal is just to build a great company, and the financial side is something that's kind of almost a bonus rather than it being the driver. And so I always think it's more interesting to do interesting things, and like actually making money itself is quite boring and quite it's great to have it, but I'd rather do something interesting. So even if I didn't make money, I'm still doing something interesting.
Yes. It's music to our ears. We always talk about that. Like, I'm more interested in talking about what you're doing with your money, what you're learning, what access that's given it to you, how you share that or not. I'm more interested in what you're doing with your money than how much of it you have, and which makes it so hard with these labels because they're usually based on like a math formula that isn't representative of liquidity or even, you know, access to capital. It's just a formula.
Or intelligence.
Like it's just there. And we take it and we make these broad assumptions and it prevents us from getting into a deeper conversation about, you know, the risks that you've taken and the rewards that you've gotten and kind of the full life and meaningful company that you're building.
I always think more about percentages than I do dollars. So I think about the idea could the idea that I'm doing grow by 50%, 100%, 200%, whatever, over some period of time. And then if it could, then I'll just invest my time into it because I see sort of the impact it's going to have, you know, so I'm really more interested in the impact. And there's a, have you ever looked at things like Net Promoter Score? You ever heard of
it? Okay. Yeah.
Or Glassdoor is another thing to look at, but companies that have high net promoter scores is basically is the how much of a customer advocates or advocates you have for your company or organization. The more advocates and promoters that you have, then the better the financial outcome is than companies that focus on the financial outcome first. So I had a guy who worked for me at one time, and I was talking to him about, you know, hey, we want to use NPS, we want to increase this, we want to, you know, try to get this into the 70s. And he literally says, I don't manage companies based on NPS. I manage them based on profit and loss statements. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, he wasn't working for me.
Yeah. I was like, that's an interesting response. Cool. Well, that wraps up our questions for you. We wanted to give you the floor and see if there's anything you want to tell our listeners about what's going on at any of your companies or where they can find you.
Yeah, well, certainly you can find me. You can find me on Twitter. Obviously, you found me on Twitter at CEO Glenn. I think my Instagram handle, even though I don't really manage it that much, but it's Glenn D. Sanford. You can find me on LinkedIn, all that stuff. But you know, I think the cool thing about success for me is this. You know, when it showed up, obviously we're still trying to figure out, you know, how does this all like work together synergistically with everything else that we're doing. We saw the brands, saw what an impact it made for me. I'd been reading the magazine for a lot of years, you know, and you can look at the who's who that's been the editor on the cover, whatever, in the 125-year existence of the magazine. It's just a really great, you know, publication that means something. The word success, you know, has a intrinsic meaning that we all consciously, subconsciously, super consciously, whatever that is. There's a word that success is. And I always say that you know success when you see it. Like it's so there's a visual aspect. You just know, you know, people are comfortable, they're good with people, I actually don't think that success is monetary, even though most people sort of put that big houses, big cars, whatever, you know, private planes, whatever that is. And in some cases that's their version of success. But I actually think it's more of a sort of a lifestyle and way of being. Mm-hmm. And that's what success sort of represents. But the other piece is the ability to sort of take that brand that's been around for 125 years and expand it into other verticals. So we're, you know, in the process of launching Success Space, which is a success co-work franchise. And, you know, and the ability to have a co-work that's, you know, not a Regis, not a WeWork, but its own place where people can drop in and be around other like-minded, positive people, you know, successful people in that they are pursuing success in a very holistic, positive way. And then having all that content from Success Magazine, plus maybe a Success Certified Coach, that if you're, you know, stuck in your business in some particular way, you can, you know, check in with the coach so they can help unblock you. And that's just a really cool way to think about, you know, business people, especially younger business people, a lot of times, you know, figuring out how do I find good advice, a good peer group, where do I plug into so I can go to the next level in this gig economy and where everybody's sort of kind of trying to do their thing. Where do they tap in and how do they get support? So I really think that's a cool thing. We're hopefully going to get some partnerships with some bigger names that are going to help us, you know, blow it up in terms of getting to, you know, I've heard the term a million subscribers. You know, we don't, our subscriber base isn't what it had been in the past. So we're going to try to figure out ways to really put this thing on steroids. And, but that's probably, you know, since we're on the success podcast, I think that's kind of some of the stuff that I think I'm pretty excited about in the success ecosystem.
I love that, especially as you're seeing, you know, some of the places and institutions where people used to go to get that coaching and camaraderie are, you know, it's declining. So fewer people are going to college immediately after high school. Fewer people are pursuing traditional employment and opting for self-employment or just kind of stringing together contracting opportunities. And so having a place where they can gather and still get the same resources that they would have gotten from a larger institution or a different path seems like it's going to be really relevant and resonate with a lot of people.
That's the idea.
Yeah.
Well, we can't wait to see it. And we're really happy to just be a part of it and to help you and the rest of the team achieve that vision. It's been great so far. And on that note, we want to say thank you for joining us and taking some time out of your day to share your story and your perspective with our listeners.
Oh, well, thanks, Kristen. Thanks, Julian. Really appreciate it. And look forward to hopefully seeing you in person here in not too distant future.
Hope so. Ready to meet everybody in person.
Yeah, it seems weird. I feel like I know you, but we've never stood next to each other.
I threaten Paige with like a hug every time I talk to her. Like, I can't wait to hug you.
Awesome. Good stuff.
Okay. So we just wrapped our interview with Glenn Sanford. Big thank you to him. First of all, let me just say he's a great listener.
He is.
I learned a lot. So I thought instead of our normal, you know, quick final thoughts, we could just do some quick takeaways from the conversation.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. And I completely agree. He's one of the best listeners that I've seen in a while. And, you know, obviously a lot of the listeners can't really see what we saw because we were recording this over a Zoom call. But he's one of those people that sort of really lock in when you're talking. And I think a lot of that is reflected throughout the interview.
Yeah. So let's start at the top with his investments. I'm not going to lie. The Crocs investment was a bit of a surprise. I never thought of him as a Crocs guy, but I get it.
It's a billionaire thing.
Yeah, apparently.
But when we light on their feet.
Some people buy yachts. Some people buy a Croc stock. But, you know, more than that, I was really validated when he said that he's using a system from the 80s to manage his investments. And it's something that he found in like a book somewhere.
Yeah, I actually need to add a couple of books and things to my wish list because he's mentioning things that I'd really never even heard
never
of.
Never even heard of.
I like to think of myself as pretty well versed in the bookscape of personal finance and money, but a couple of things I'd never really heard of. And I also didn't even know that he started his career as a stockbroker. So that was actually really interesting.
Yeah. There was a couple of times where he was like, you know, the blah, 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 right? And I'm like, no. But it just proves the point, like in a world where there's a lot of flashy financial experts who are always advocating for these risky investments or paywalled advice, it just speaks to the longevity of good old boring book public financial strategies. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, for him, it's not just the approach to investing. It looks like it's part of like his operating system.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like how he governs and thinks through certain decision making. So it was really fascinating to watch. I think for me, I was really enjoying the part where we were geeking out a little bit about the future of virtual reality.
Yeah, that was a geek session.
It was. But, you know, I mean, that's an entire conversation in and of itself, VR, AR, and all of that stuff. So that part I really enjoyed. I also thought it was really validating for me as when he was talking about how he acquired success enterprises and he spoke about that really short window of opportunity for investments and business opportunities and market opportunities. That is probably one of the best stories. He's told us personally online and offline a couple stories, but I really, really enjoyed that because
I think the same way about some things. You have to have capital set aside for when lightning strikes and you have an opportunity to catch it in a bottle. Mm-hmm. What were your thoughts on his cryptocurrency strategy?
Yes. Now, that was where I started geeking out because, I mean, his strategy is very similar to mine. Who doesn't want to buy a crypto boat? Yeah. Like, that is the goal.
Yeah.
I think if I had a crypto boat, I would have to name it, like, after a coin or maybe just, like, coin boat or something.
Yeah, you could be a little bit more creative than that.
Anyway, in all seriousness, you know my favorite form of history is living history. And so as I was listening to what it took to buy a Bitcoin back then and trying to translate that level of effort into today's terms, I really started to think about what kind of investments or opportunities am I avoiding because it seems like it's too much effort. Mm. Like he was talking about going to ATMs and logging into Second Life and all that stuff. And especially when he was talking about in 2016, when everything was going terrible, the market was going hell in a handbasket, like he said, because of the election. And he had $5,000 and he had $5,000 and he decided to invest it in Coinbase. And like my new goal is to build that instinct in myself, because right now when it's hell in a handbasket, like my instinct is not to put the money somewhere where I can't see it and can't touch it. Like I want it in front of me.
Keep it close.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really, really enjoyed that. And I certainly got a lot out of it. I think our listeners got a lot out of it. But ultimately, you know, my biggest takeaway, and I actually anticipated this leading into the interview, was around when we were discussing identity. Glenn is unquestionably a billionaire, but he does not identify with that term. And again, people can't really see his facial expressions. You kind of have to take our word for it. It's not something that he wears with pride, you know? No. And that's not to say that that's, you know, virtuous or not. It's just not something that he actually identifies with because of the way that he thinks about money and because of the way that he thinks about wealth. And that's a very similar sort of feeling when we think about even our own brand and our own identity, this idea of being rich and regular.
Yes. Yes. Well, we hope you enjoyed the episode as much as we did. Since giving us a billion stars is not a possibility, if you get a moment, please check us out on the ratings and review page and leave a 5-star review if you like what you heard. We will see you next week.